place and ready to go on the next case? All right, the next case we've got on calendar is 61715, clustered with 65819665 or 66452, Cashman Equipment versus West Edna Associates. Are you ready, Ms. Loy? Okay, if you'd come on.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jennifer Loy from Howard & Howard Attorneys on behalf of Cashman Equipment Company. I have here with me Brian Pizzolo. May it please the Court, if I may have 3 minute rebuttal.
Yes, of course.
Thank you. I'd like to note at the outset the Mojave parties, the respondents here today, Mojave Electric, Western Surety Company, and Whiting Turner Contracting Company, along with the owner entities of the project, raised issues outside of those appealed by Cashman in their respondents' brief and did request relief that would increase their rights under the judgment, even though they did not file a notice of appeal or a cross appeal in this matter. I would submit their jurisdiction barred from making those arguments, and the timely notice of appeal is mandatory and jurisdictional with respect to these arguments. This Court has consistently refused to consider issues raised by respondents outside of their, in their briefing, when they do not file a notice of appeal or cross appeal. This case is about Cashman being paid just once for materials it supplied to the new Las Vegas City Hall project. This appeal centers on the District Court's denial of Cashman's statutory and contractual rights to payments for those materials. I'd like to address today the three main errors made by the District Court in its decision after trial in this matter. The first error I'd like to discuss is the error in enforcing the unconditional waiver and release that Cashman provided in exchange for a check that's actually void as a matter of law in releasing Cashman's mechanics lien claim on the project. After trial, the District Court found that Cashman had properly perfected and enforced its mechanics lien pursuant to NRS Chapter 108. It further found that Cashman owed approximately $683,000 for the materials it supplied and incorporated into the project. The court then denied recovery, finding that the release was valid, even though pursuant to NRS 108-2457, subsection 5E, that release is void as a matter of law. The statute states, notwithstanding any language in any waiver and release form set forth in this section, if the payment given in exchange for any waiver and release of lien is made by check, draft, or other negotiable instrument, and the same fails to clear the bank on which it is drawn for any reason, then the waiver and release shall be deemed null, void, and of no legal effect whatsoever, and all lien rights, liens, lien rights, bond rights, contract rights, or any other right to payment afforded to the lien claimant in law or equity will not be affected by the lien claimant's execution of the waiver and release. The testimony at trial of Mr. Merman from Cashman established that the check was, that the release that he provided that day was exchanged for a check from him, the party Cashman had contracted with. That payment then did not clear the bank. Testimony at trial was further that Cashman relied upon the provisions of NRS 108-2457, subsection 5E, in providing that release that day, understanding that if the payment did not clear, its release would not be enforceable against it. The language of the statute is clear and unambiguous. Where a waiver and release is given in exchange for a payment by check and that check fails to clear the bank, then that waiver is null, void, and of no legal effect. Another portion of that statute provides that in order for a waiver to be valid, the lien claimant must give a written waiver in the form provided by the statute, and that it can only waive its lien rights to the extent it receives payment. Here, Cashman did not receive any payment, and that's undisputed.
Ms. Loy, can you tell me, what did Judge Baer say was his ruling on that particular issue? His explanation is that the check failed to clear the bank, why the waiver and lien release would be valid?
Judge Baer, in his decision, noted that the payment from Mojave to CAM, the party that then paid Cashman, was good. That payment did clear the bank. So the court ruled that that payment would be the payment that made Cashman's lien release enforceable. But clearly the statute provides that the lien payment must receive the payment, not some other third party, in order to make that lien waiver valid. To hold, as the court did, that payment to a higher-tiered contractor waives the lien rights of a lower-tiered contractor, where that lower-tiered contractor doesn't actually get payment, would render the lien statutes meaningless in many instances. It would provide no incentive for higher-tiered contractors and owners to ensure payment to all parties providing work on a project. This court's precedent is clear that the mechanics lien is a statutory remedy that's to ensure payment to lien claimants on projects. And they're remedial in character and should be liberally construed in favor of the lien claimants. The purpose is not to make them confusing or to obtain a waiver where the lien claimant hasn't been paid in an attempt to enforce it against them to release their lien rights. Given that the district court found that Cashman's lien was properly perfected and found that they owed $683,000 at trial, we would ask that judgment be entered in favor of Cashman on its lien claim, and this matter be remanded for a determination of attorney's fees, costs, and interest pursuant to NRS 108-237. The second error committed by the district court that I'm going to discuss here today was its failure to enforce Cashman's payment bond claim against the payment bond obtained by Mojave on the project.
Can I ask you one question before you go to get into that on the waiver pursuant to the statute? Respondents are claiming that the Cashman's claim was excessive and essentially a double payment. Which brings up the question to me, and I think I know the answer to this anyway, but was the payment to the bank that was originally made stopped, or was it just, it was rejected for insufficient funds?
The payment that Cam made to Cashman, he stopped payment on that check, Cam did.
Okay.
Such that it didn't clear the bank.
All right, so it wasn't the fact that the funds weren't there. So they were arguing at that time that the lien was excessive?
At that point, they didn't argue the lien was excessive. That came later on at trial when it was discovered that Cashman had provided materials to the project through a different subcontractor after Cam disappeared and had actually received a payment for those materials. It was a battery that is actually installed at the end of the job. And so that's why at trial we reduced the lien claim to reflect that credit down to $683,000, as is allowed by the lien statutes, when we discovered that that was amendment was necessary.
And Cashman's claim was that that was simply an oversight mistake.
It was simply an oversight, and it was because that battery was actually sold to a different electrical subcontractor, not Mojave. And in fact, I don't think there was awareness that it had been incorporated into the project.
Okay. Thank you. You answered my question.
Thank you, Your Honor. The payment bond, the district court refused to enforce the claim against the payment bond based upon the defense of impossibility. The defense of impossibility requires that there be an unforeseen contingency that renders performance impossible. If it's one that the promisor should have foreseen, then it's not available as a defense to discharge the obligations. And here, really, the non-payment of a material supplier on a construction project is not an unforeseen contingency. It's why we have mechanics and statutes. It's why they were required to obtain a payment bond in this instance. So it's difficult to see how that was determined to be an unforeseen contingency. The Mojave obtaining the payment bond really bargained for that contingency, as it required Mojave to ensure payment to all parties supplying in the performance of its contract on the project, not just those that it contracted with. It understood that obligation, and it understood that it needed to ensure payment to those parties to discharge its obligations to third parties like Cashman. Mojave was aware of the risk of non-payment. The testimony at trial was that Mojave understood that paying CAM was not sufficient to discharge its obligations under the payment bond. It recognized that it did have additional obligations that it did not fulfill. And it's important to note here that Cashman took steps to attempt to obtain a joint check from Mojave in order to avoid just this instance occurring, and that Mojave simply refused to issue the joint check. The joint check was fulfilled a few purposes here. It would have allowed the waiver that Cashman provided to be valid and enforceable. Mojave would have known it was valid and enforceable because it had issued a joint check in exchange for the waiver and knowing that its funds were good. Secondly, it would have discharged its obligations under the payment bond because it would have ensured payment to Cashman, and that's what it needed to do. That was its obligation that it contracted to do in obtaining the payment bond. Again, because the district court found that Cashman supplied the materials to the project and is owed $683,000, and given the clear error in applying the defense of impossibility to discharge Mojave's obligations under the payment bond, we would ask the judgment be entered in favor of Cashman, the district court reversed on that issue, and that we would be awarded judgment on the payment bond claim as well. The third error I'm going to discuss today was the district court's application of a comparative fault analysis to reduce Cashman's damage award on its valid and enforceable security interest. The district court found after trial that Cashman had a valid and enforceable security interest properly perfected in the materials it supplied to the project. It found that Mojave had received over $1.2 million for those materials and that Cashman's security interest would attach to the value received. However, instead of awarding the amount due Cashman under the contract, the district court reduced the award by applying an equitable fault analysis, essentially looking at the actions of the parties in contracting with CAM on the project. Cashman thinks that it's improper to allocate damages based on a comparative fault analysis where the damages and the security interest are based on a contract, and it bargained for to receive the value of its contract, and it supplied its materials, and so it should get what it bargained for, and it should receive payment in the full amount. The equitable fault analysis really ignores the evidence at trial, the contractual liabilities of the parties, and the structure put in place on the project that would allow Cashman to supply these materials, and it should then be paid in the amount that it is owed. We would request then that the district court also be reversed on this issue, that the comparative fault analysis is not appropriate in determining the damage award on Cashman's contractual security interest, and that judgment be entered in favor of Cashman and the full amount found owed by the district court at trial, which is $683,000. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, you've got 2 minutes and 57 seconds. Manny, you want to reserve that?
Yes, please.
I will address some of the points that counsel addressed and also some points that I think that counsel did not address and left out. One of the issues in this case that gets missed, and there are a lot of statutes and there are a lot of cases that have been cited in the briefing, but one issue that kind of gets glossed over here is that Cashman, at the point of payment, when the unconditional final lien release was tendered, when the checks were exchanged, Cashman made an election to accept a post-dated check from CAM and Carvalho. The reason that's significant in this scenario, on this factual analysis, is because the testimony and evidence at trial was clear that Cashman had chosen to use this disadvantaged business entity on this project. They were given three choices, and they went with this entity, even though when they ran a credit report, a credit check, they found out that this entity didn't have any funds and didn't have any credit because it was basically a brand new entity.
Counsel, wasn't this one of the entities that was put forth by your client?
My client gave them a number of options. That's correct. This was at the end of the day, this was the cheapest option.
Did your client do any checks into, making that argument now that they didn't have any funds, but if your client proffered this entity up as an option, did you have an obligation to do some background checks on those options that were tendered?
We had worked with all three of the options prior to offering them up to Cashman.
So you didn't have any problem with offering them up in the first place?
We didn't have any problem. My clients didn't have any problem with payment from them on the projects that they'd worked on.
So now you're arguing that somehow they should be at fault for selecting this particular contractor?
Well, that's what Judge Bear determined when, and again, when we start dealing with comparative liability. The testimony at trial from their PMK, from Cashman's PMK, was that they ran CAM's credit, and they ran Mr. Carvalho's credit, and they had some concerns, but that they elected to go forward with them anyway. My argument goes more to the point of, had Cashman, and this is a recurring theme in this case, had Cashman chosen to do things differently, they would have been paid in full. There was argument made by counsel that they tried to get a joint check in this case. Well, if Cashman's sitting in Mojave's office and says, we're not going to give you an unconditional final lien release unless we get a joint check, Mojave, being a subcontractor to Whiting Turner and to the owner, is going to give them a joint check. They're not going to have a choice. They have to get that unconditional final lien release. So when Cashman argues, and they did this at trial, again, to Linda DeVale, when they say that, well, we tried to get a joint check, well, they asked for a joint check, but they didn't insist on it. And that, among other things, would have solved this problem. They could have...
So what they asked for a joint check, and your position is that if a joint check were issued, there wouldn't be an issue here today. But what were they supposed to do when Mojave denied the request to issue a joint check?
They could have done any number of things. They could have had CAM sign the check directly over to them and write a check to CAM for the $37,000. They could have taken a contemporaneous check from CAM. They could have gone to the bank. They knew, Cashman knew, that Mojave's funds that from the check that was tendered were good. They'd had a long history with Mojave and Whiting Turner and had never had a
joint check. But you had with CAM?
We had a couple of projects. Mojave had a couple of projects with CAM. Cashman had never had a project with CAM. They had never worked with CAM before. In this scenario...
Were there any such representations made to Cashman to that in that regard? Mojave had prior relationships with CAM and didn't have any issues?
There were when they were offered up. We indicated to Cashman that we had worked with CAM on a couple of occasions, we had worked with Medco, and there was another DB that was in play, and that we had not had any issues with them at that point. However, we had also never taken a post-dated check from CAM. We had never had to rely on CAM's credit. We never had to rely on CAM having a window of time by which we would rely on their money and not money that was coming down from a higher tiered contractor. The issue here is that Cashman wants to kind of paint this into a limited box under Chapter 108 and say that they are an aggrieved supplier that the statutes are designed to protect. Now, my partner Dennis Haney drafted a lot of these statutes, so we've gotten to know them fairly well. But in this situation, Cashman, as soon as they know that they've got payment coming down to them, and they accept, and they take on the risk of taking on a post-dated check, what Judge Bear determined was that at that point, the payment, quote-unquote, the payment that was made by Mojave, was the payment to satisfy the lien statute and the unconditional final lien release.
Even though the post-dated check was executed by CAM.
That's correct.
And which causes me to ask the question, it was a post-dated check. Was it tendered to the bank after the post-date?
The testimony of trial was that it was.
The significance of it being a post-dated check then, when they stopped payment on it, rather than having it not cleared for insufficient funds, why is that an issue?
Well, it's an issue because if the check is dated the same day, and if Cashman goes to the bank that day and there's a stop payment put on it, at that point Cashman can call Mojave and tell Mojave, okay, hold on, CAM is playing games with us, stop payment on their check, which we would have been able to do. When Cashman called Mojave, basically a week and change after the fact, and said, hey, we've got a problem with CAN's payment. They issued a stop check notice. You need to stop their payment. It was too late at that point for us to do anything, and Carvalho and CAM had taken that window of opportunity and have started with the funds, a window of opportunity that they never should have had.
All that being said, it looks as if your client did the proper thing, which was put in place a payment bond, which all of a sudden, through this alleged impossibility, it's not being honored. Isn't that for the protection of your client, and why shouldn't it have been honored, the use of the payment bond?
Well, it's for the protection of the project, and for the general contractor, Wedding Turner, in this case in particular.
Well, and also for the party that provided the services to get paid.
Correct. And in this case, what Judge Baer determined, and we think properly in this case, was that it was impossible for Mojave, having tendered more than sufficient funds to the entity that it was contractually bound to tender funds to, CAM, it was impossible for them to foresee, and I agree with this, that in the interim, Cashman was going to accept the post-dated check, then wait until after the post-date, several days later, to attempt to tender it.
We had 2 days, Counselor.
I understand.
Don't make it sound like it was an eternity, because it wasn't.
Well, it wasn't an eternity, but it was certainly enough time for this DBE to go out and abscond the funds and spend them somewhere else. Had this paid
off. Isn't that the purpose of having a bond, is to make sure if something occurs, everyone's quote is protected?
Well, something foreseeable occurs. And for purposes of 108 and the payment bond, everything that needed to happen with respect to this project happened in Mojave's audit. It all happened that day. The post-dated check and CAM Consulting and Carvalho basically stealing the funds and liquidating their bank account before Cashman was able to cash what was extended funds from Mojave certainly wasn't a foreseeable consequence. This isn't a situation where you've got an owner that's...
You want us to let your client totally off because he made payment, period.
I don't think it's fair to let my client totally off because of the total payment. But yes, that was what Judge Baer determined, was that the payment was made and that it was impossible and unforeseeable for my client to know what was going to transpire after the fact with the post-dated check and with this client basically stealing
the
money.
How does the court describe impossible? Because it was hard for me to discern reading through what made it impossible.
How did the court discern that? I think he, looking at the cases in state, looked at it as saying it was unforeseeable and that my client could not have done anything differently than it had with respect to this situation because we have a contractual obligation to pay CAM as required by the owner, a DBE on the project. We're contractually obligated to pay them. They then have an obligation to turn around and pay Cashman. What happened in the interim between us tendering valid for more than enough funds to pay them both and what ultimately happened with Carvalho and CAM basically stealing the money was absolutely unforeseeable because we didn't know that they were post-date the check and wait. We had no way to know that this entity was going to turn around and steal the money. That's what we argued, and that's what Judge Baer determined in his findings.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Now, I understand why your client got caught in the middle on this. I get that. But I'm concerned about this transaction where this post-dated check was issued for the release, which now appears to be fraud, like that, with stopping payment and all that. Is there a failure of consideration for obtaining the release and waiver of the mechanics lien because of the fraud? Even though it's a post-dated check, the whole transaction is structured as a fraud. That's what bothers me. Having done a lot of this type of litigation as a lawyer and all like that, you've got to have the consideration for it, and the consideration is never really furnished unless your argument's a promissory note type of thing.
Well, exactly. I mean, that was what we said at the trial, and that's when the judge made the determination, when Judge Baer made the determination that for purposes of the lien release, the payment, as defined in that document, was made because my client did make the payment in exchange for the lien release, that everything that happened after that with the post-dated check and the transaction between CAM and Cashman whereby Cashman makes an independent business decision to accept a post-dated check and then wait to cash it and gives them this window of time to abscond with the facts.
I don't see how that invalidates the lien. Yeah, that's my problem here. I mean, I get all that, but it seems like Cashman would have an argument their lien was still in place. Then you can litigate over successive or whatever, you know, get into court, get credit for the payments and all that. But it's just they were defrauded into releasing this lien, and that really concerns me on it. And I know you don't represent the company committed the fraud, but they did. You know.
Well, and again, this is a tricky case because obviously you've got two parties. I mean, you know, for lack of a better phrase, there isn't a bad guy sitting here. Cashman got duped, for lack of a better word, by Cam and Carvalho, and my client made the payment for the materials that were supplied. So it's a tricky situation. What the court found, what Judge Baer found, and what we've been arguing, is that when you're looking at a situation like that, you've got to look at, okay, the responsibilities of the parties and whether, you know, because someone's going to have to get punished. Either Cashman's going to not get paid for materials in full that they supplied, or Mojave's going to have to pay twice. And what Judge Baer determined was that when we made the payment and were given the unconditional final lien release, that at that point, that issue is over, and that the arrangement between Cam and Cashman with the post-dated check and the absconding of funds was essentially a separate transaction, akin to a promissory note, as Your Honor just articulated. But that was Judge Baer's concern, and that was his ruling as well.
Counsel,
certainly.
The foundation of your argument is that the court should engage in an equitable analysis or an equitable fault analysis in making a determination about this particular problem. This seems to be an issue of first impression in Nevada as to whether or not the district court should engage in an equitable fault analysis when dealing with statutory mechanics liens. The Land case suggests that's not proper. In fact, specifically states that equity jurisprudence has no place in determining the rights of mechanics lien holders. We should focus only on the statutes that govern. What say you to that point? And if this court is going to sanction equitable jurisprudence to overlay mechanics lien statutes, that seems to me to create a whole series of unintended consequences, where now we're going to come in and the focus is going to be on the district court weighing equities of mechanics lien claimants and contractors rather than sticking with the statutory foundation for mechanics lien analysis.
And as an attorney with a lot of clients that deal in this realm of law, that is a concern that we have as well. Having said that, I don't think this factual analysis, this factual scenario, fits neatly into Chapter 108 or Chapter 624. The concern that we have is...
So isn't that something the legislature should take up? You're asking this court to evaluate this and sanction the use of equitable jurisprudence to resolve this problem. That's the root of your claim here.
Not necessarily. I think what I'm saying is that the district court and Judge Baer made a determination that for purposes of the unconditional final lien release, that the payment that needed to be made, and if I may push and answer your question, that the payment that needed to be made, the payment, was made, and that payment made by Mojave satisfied the terms of the unconditional final lien release, and that with respect to the bond, that everything going forward was impossible to foresee. I don't believe that is an equitable determination. I think that the judge, in determining whether that payment constituted the payment,
but didn't the judge engage in fault allocation? Mojave and Cashman are innocent victims here. Cashman is 67% responsible. Mojave is 33%. It sounds like the judge is engaging in a comparative negligence evaluation here. There's nothing in the mechanics lien statutes that allow the judge to do that.
But Your Honor is reading from the UCC portion of the findings, yeah. I believe. But I don't think he made those determinations with respect to the mechanics lien statute, the mechanics lien claim. The mechanics lien claim was satisfied by the judge by finding that the payment that was required by the unconditional final lien release was actually made. And to get to that point, I don't believe he had to use comparative analysis, but he looked at the totality of the circumstances as to what Cashman did, what Mojave did, and the tendering of that payment, and determined that the payment satisfied the unconditional release for the lien statutes. I don't believe that that finding or this court's upholding of that finding would have any impact on the lien statutes or strict interpretation of lien statutes going forward. I certainly hope not.
One more question for you. Just going back to something counsel had referred to earlier. In your answering brief, you made some indications that the judge ruled incorrectly in Cashman's favor on several matters, including the unjust enrichment, the foreclosure of the security interest, misrepresentation, and denial of your attorney's fees and costs. Are you saying you are seeking redress for those issues that were raised in your answering brief? And if so, what rule gives you that authority to do?
I think what we're saying is if the court is inclined to remand this entire dispute back to the district court, and the court is inclined, because we didn't cross-appeal. We're content, I guess, be the right word, with the court's findings and conclusions, even though we didn't necessarily agree with them. If the court is inclined to remand, is inclined to remand the entire case back, then we would ask that the court be, that the remand include the ability to litigate all the issues, not just a handful of issues picked and chosen by the appellants in this case, which we think, again, and there's briefing on this, and the court, I think, agreed with us in the decision, we think that would be proper if the case is remanded, but we're not asking for the case to be remanded, we're not asking for the case to be upheld.
That answers my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. Anyone has any questions?
Any counsel, any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Loy, you should come up. Maybe you don't want to come on up. But my question about the fraud on the with the post-dated check, and counsel says if you accept a post-dated check, it's like a promissory note, it's a replacement. Therefore, there is no fraud. It's your client accepted the risk of getting paid later, and that makes the lien waiver at least valid. Well, what's your position on that?
I think it's important to note the testimony at trial was that Cashman was not aware when it accepted the check that it was post-dated. And in the exchange of payment that day at Mojave's offices, which occurred almost 3 months after Cashman delivered the materials to the project and they were being installed, Mojave gave a check to Cam, and Cam gave a check to Cashman. So Mojave was aware that Cam needed its funds to pay Cashman. And Cam said that day to Cashman, sitting at the table, all the parties, said, you know, I need to deposit Mojave's check before I can, my check to you will be good. But I'm giving you this check today in exchange for your waiver. And so Cashman said, okay, I understand that. You know, that is not an uncommon practice.
So the representation was the check was good.
Yes.
And then they just had to clear the Mojave check.
That's correct. That's
now,
correct.
What about this thing, counsel saying that you could have got the joint check if you asked for it, and that would have protected you on this? What's your position on that?
I think that's a really good point. And Cashman repeatedly called after delivery requesting that Mojave issue a joint check because there was some worry about Cam after delivery because Cam, the principal of Cam, it was just one person's company. He was in the military, he said, and he said he was overseas, and there was some concern about when payment was going to be made, the timing of payment. And Cashman had had a lot of dealings with Mojave, had bid this job to Mojave initially, and Mojave said, no, we need to do a DBE on this. We want credit for DBE, so we need to find someone to do this between us. So Cashman says, okay, and then here's Cam. So I think that given that Cam had been kind of hard to reach, Cashman started calling Mojave, when are you guys going to issue payment? Oh, we're going to issue payment when we get paid. Again, a normal occurrence on a construction project. Cashman says, okay, I understand that. That's fine. And then that's why when Mojave called the meeting that day to have the payment exchange, it occurred right at Mojave's offices. All the parties were present for the exchange of the checks. So it's difficult for me to understand how Mojave can say Cashman had the ability to require it to issue a joint check. Cashman requested a joint check repeatedly, and Mojave repeatedly refused. Even though it really had no basis for the refusal, it simply said, I didn't want...
Could you have taken additional steps at that point, and what were those steps have been?
I'm not really sure given the way that the parties were set up. You have Cashman as the lowest tier here. It has the least ability to control how payment is made, when payment is made. It's really the party that the mechanics lien statutes were intended to protect. It really places the onus, the legislature determined, to place the burden on owners and higher-tiered contractors to ensure that payment is made. And that's why NRS 108-2457 is so clear that a lien claimant can only waive payment and will only waive its lien rights where it has received the payment, not that the payment was made to someone else, some other third party.
Please finish your thought.
That the lien claimant received that payment to waive its lien rights. And it made that determination. And Your Honor was correct in that equity has it can't be used to disregard the statutory requirements that the parties are relying on, that Cashman relied on in this instance to supply those materials to that project.
Can I ask you one more question? Justice Gibbons had indicated earlier perhaps there was no consideration given for this unconditional waiver release in the sense that there was a stop payment on the check and therefore there was no consideration given. How does that figure into this? If you remember the question that he asked.
I think that it is applicable and that there should be an exchange of value for there to be a valid waiver of the lien rights. And that is really set forth in NRS 108-2547. It specifically addresses that in order to waive those lien rights, you must receive that payment.
Okay.
As a practical matter, the risk of loss is always going to be on the paying party where you have this payment to one party that's to be passed through to the third party who is giving the lien release in exchange for it. That's your reading of that statute.
It is, and it's in accord really with this court's adoption of the joint check rule, yeah. Allowing the owner or higher tier contractor to ensure payment goes where it's supposed to by issuing that joint check. And they have the money, they control the payment, and that's why it works.
So that's the fix.
That is, Your Honor, that's correct.
Quick question as to the argument that was raised when I asked the question about the payment bond and the defense of impossibility. You seem to assert that there was nothing put forth at the trial level about the impossibility. What's your answer today?
That's correct, Your Honor. They never really submitted evidence showing that they could not perform. And that defense is really only available where you have the unforeseen contingency and then performance is impossible. The surety bond is still in place. I think it's clear that Mojave simply doesn't want to pay Cashman. But that's why we have these remedies available for situations just like this.
You said unforeseen, they assert foreseeability. That's...
I think that it's foreseeable that there could be non-payment on a construction project, and that's why we have the mechanics lien and why we have payment bonds. I think what CAM did may not have been foreseeable, but the non-payment was foreseeable, and they bargained for that risk when they obtained that payment bond.
All right. Ms. Lloyd, Mr. Burson, thank you both for your excellent arguments today. This case will stand submitted. This